host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockeypedia cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy Jack Hahn. Jack, what's going on, man?
So it's final four time.
It is final four time indeed. We've taken this journey together so far. We started off before round one. We had to preview 16 different teams. It was quite the exercise. Now we whittled it down to the final four, and it's a fitting final four because, in my opinion, they're comfortably the best teams in each of their divisions they're representing respectively. So it's going to make for a really fun conference finals. And the plan for today is for you and I to do what we've done before every round. We're going to hopefully get people ready for the conference finals by just loading you up with as much information as we can, everything you need to know about the matchups, what to look for when you're watching the games, and all that good stuff. So we'll break them down one at a time. And let's start off with the East Series, Panthers Rangers. I was just saying to you before we went on the air that I got to the office this morning. I started doing my notes, doing my prep, getting into it. And I was actually a bit surprised to find that I just had more stuff to say, I think, on Panthers Rangers. I think it's a very fascinating matchup. I'm really excited to dive into it with you. Certainly we'll have a lot on Stars Oilers in the second half of today's show as well, but let's start off with that one. What is the most interesting part of Panthers Rangers to you, either from what you saw from them in round two or just kind of how you figure they stack up against each other head to head?
So I like my pick to come out of the East originally was Carolina, and obviously they lost the Rangers. And the reason why they lost was, you know, obviously in terms of goaltending, Shesterkin outperformed Freddie Anderson. But in terms of special teams, they just got completely bamboozled. And even though Carolina did their thing at 5-on-5, where they, you know, had more shots, they had somewhat more zone time, New York did a good job off the rush and counterattacking. And also, again, on special teams, like that's where the series was won. And Florida is, I would say, like they're similar to Carolina in a lot of ways, in which like I'd expect them again to have maybe a little bit more control at 5-on-5. But like the Rangers have the best special teams of, I would say, any team still left in the entire playoffs, if you look at both power play and PK. So like, again, that's probably where the margin of victory is going to come down.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you look at this postseason so far and the Rangers power play is scoring over 13 goals per hour. And I'm curious to see how that shakes out, because Florida's penalty kill, particularly when, you know, they have Barkov and Reinhardt out there and Forsling, can apply a lot of pressure, do similar things theoretically to what Carolina typically doesn't have success with and didn't really have success with against New York. What did you see from them in terms of the way they kind of move the puck around? Because obviously there's other great power plays around the league. We're going to talk about one of them in the West Series involving Edmonton. And theirs is more so movement based in terms of McDavid kind of moving around the offensive zone and probing for openings and trying to get two-man games going. New York's is much more of a team effort, right? Like when they're humming, even you look at the tip goal that Kreider scored in game six that put them over the top. Everyone on the ice touched the puck. The puck is just moving so quickly. There's so much chemistry between all the players involved. How do you sort of defend that? Because it really feels like, unlike other top power plays, they're very happy to essentially take whatever you give them and then beat you that way. It's not necessarily just kind of prioritized around one single weapon.
Yeah. And the thing with New York, as you mentioned, it's the chemistry, because that unit's been together for a while now. And the biggest change was swapping out Ryan Strome for Vinny Trocheck. And I think Trocheck is a better all-around player than Strome was. So, you know, from the bumper spot, he really elevates that unit. And the way that they beat Carolina a lot of times, it's either right off the face-off where they string three or four passes together, you know, because obviously the puck, when it's being moved tape to tape, it moves faster than even Carolina's pressure. So they were able to get ahead of the pressure and then, you know, find the middle of the ice or find kind of one of their set plays, or they were able to, on a re-entry, quickly get the puck off the wall and into the middle of the ice again, because Carolina loves to sort of overplay that corner battle and to win the puck back quickly. Florida does a lot of the same things on their PK. They play more of a diamond, like it's more noticeable, whereas Carolina, like you don't even really know what kind of shape they're in, because it's just four guys running at you. But you know, against the diamond PK, it's the interior players like Trocheck and Kreider. If New York can get the puck quickly to them, like they can cause a lot of chaos.
Well, what's interesting, I've been kind of noting it as the postseason's gone along, is that Florida has really been more disciplined. I'm sure if you ask Jim Montgomery or a Bruins fan, they might disagree with that. But they just to my eye, it feels like, last year they went into the postseason and they were the underdog right out of the gate, and they sort of had to create this chaotic environment where they were just trying to just include as much variance as they could into their games. And part of that is a bunch of penalties and trying to kind of go right up to the line and sometimes even going over it, but it being a net positive for them. This postseason, they've toned down the penalties. They've taken many fewer of them. I'm curious to see if they're able to kind of maintain that, where this is much more of a coin flip series and they don't even have home ice to start off. So maybe the perception is a little bit different. But what I love about this matchup in particular is it feels like it's exactly how the postseason should go, in the sense that both teams in this round are playing sort of a similar version stylistically to the teams they played in the previous round, except just souped up versions, right? And so from the Panthers' perspective, they play this Bruins team where they're not going to have the puck as frequently as them, and we saw that kind of borne out in those games. But they're a precision passing kind of execution team off of set plays, and having that, even though the centers have changed and they've lost some guys along the years, having that kind of chemistry and organizational continuity. Now they play this Rangers team. This similarly is right up there for my money as the best passing team in the league, and you see it in that on that power play situations we're talking about. And they rely so much on that efficiency and execution against Florida's pressure and pursuit, which is what Carolina plays like. And so I'm curious, this series is starting on May 22nd, I believe. It'll be a long one. It's going to stretch into June. I'm curious, do you think it impacts it at all from like New York's perspective, that I imagine as we get closer into June here, weather's heating up. I think the ice surfaces are going to become more choppy and sort of create maybe more or less predictable environments in terms of where the puck's bouncing and the ability to kind of execute some of those clean passing plays. Do you think that benefits Florida a little bit more just from kind of their acceptance of broken plays and chaos? Or do you think that's not really a big deal in the series?
Well, I mean, certainly, I think for players like Panarin, not having good ice is going to be an issue because, it's so much about finesse and keeping the puck on the ice and finding lanes. For players like, again, Trocheck and Kreider, it's not going to be as much of an issue. And that's why I think New York's power play is so hard to shut down, is because basically on that five-man unit, every single play style is represented. You have the guy who loves to have the puck and to quarterback the play in Panarin and also Adam Fox. You have a guy who's in front of the net and really doesn't really care how the puck comes. He's just going to whack it in the net or tip it in midair in Kreider. You have the big one-timer for Zibanejad, and then Trocheck does a bit of everything, and also a very good faceoff player. So this time of the year, you have some very good power play units who inexplicably goes quiet, and I would say Carolina is the latest one where I was kind of expecting more from them. I think they ended up either getting outscored on the power play or it was like 1-1 in the whole series, which was kind of wild. But the reason why New York's power play has held up so well is just because they can attack you in every single way. They got tons of set plays. Their handedness, their skill set is all dialed in. And again, like, it doesn't matter what you do, they can find ways to hurt you.
Well, and I think it's an important note that you made there about their shorthanded prowess as well. For the postseason, I've got them at 4 goals scored shorthanded and 4 goals against. So they've broken even in over 60 minutes of penalty kill time. And the reason why that's relevant is because I think we know that, especially as the postseason progresses, the refs generally try to manage these games by evening out penalties. And if it's favoring one team, it's going to come back and even out the other way. And so from the Rangers' perspective, if the Panthers get back into that sort of, all right, after every whistle, we're going to create a scrum and there's going to be a bunch of 4-on-4s and penalties being divvied up, they're probably pretty comfortable in that, where all of a sudden they get the power plays and we know what they can do, but they're not going to be worried about it coming back to bite them once it turns the other way. So I think that's an interesting thing to note. Let's talk a bit about more. You mentioned Panarin there, and everyone that listens to this show knows that I'm contractually obligated to spread the good word about my boy Gus Forsling, and he did nothing in round 2 to dissuade that. If anything, kind of reinforced it, just because we watch him play and he's just such a deterrent with his stick. It's just kind of I've made this comparison about other strong defenders before, but it's basically the biggest equivalent you can find to like a rim protector in basketball, where his ability with his stick and his reach to impact plays, you can see it changing the way skilled players trying to attack him have to go about it. And they're making plays earlier than they would. They're not allowing stuff to develop the way they typically would. And it really kind of forces them out of their rhythm. In round one, he goes head to head with Kucherov. Tampa Bay scores just 2 5-on-5 goals in nearly 50 minutes of that head to head matchup. In round two, he plays Pasternak 53 minutes head to head. Boston scores just 2 goals. Gus Forsling himself scored 2 goals, including the series clincher. And so the reason why I note that, and I'm curious for your take on how it applies to this series, is in each of those matchups, it was very easy to forecast that if Florida basically choked out their opponent's primary offensive source, that being Kucherov and Rana and the Pasternak in round two, those teams just didn't really have like a meaningful outlet for secondary scoring and someone they could turn to pick up the load in other matchups. In this one, it seems like on paper, based on the regular season and even what we saw in round two, that would kind of apply to Panarin's line. I just think if you're the Rangers, you probably have to hope that particularly that Zibanejad Kreider line can pick up where they left off at the end of the Carolina series and maybe get going. But they've struggled at times to score 5-on-5 themselves. So do you think if you're Paul Maurice and you're kind of laying out the cards for this matchup, that you're sort of applying a similar game plan and strategy, kind of viewing it, all right, if we devote all of our defensive resources to Panarin's line, we'll feel good about everything else? Or do you think there's kind of more contextual things to consider in the head-to-heads?
I mean, like looking at Florida's decor, the main thing that they're going to try to do is try to not shelter, but deploy Montour in a way to as to first of all maximize his offense, but second of all avoid the Rangers' top six. If you look at the other members of the Panthers' decor, like they're bigger, stronger players. Like especially an especially poor matchup for the Panthers will be having Montour defend Kreider down low and in the D zone in general. But also, they probably don't love seeing Montour trying to defend Panarin either. So, they don't have home ice advantage. And in terms of deployment, again, like the main thing that I would be trying to do as Florida is to give Montour, more ozone starts, deploy him more against the Rangers' bottom six, and so on and so forth. And when you do that, you don't really have a ton of flexibility in terms of how you deploy your other two pairs. So you may play Forsling and Ekblad more, but also, the third pair, which has been Ekman-Larsson and Kulikov, like they're going to have to play some useful minutes as well.
They certainly will. In that Carolina matchup in round two, the Rangers generated 12 5-on-5 goals, and 7 of them were scored by the Panarin, Lafreniere, Trocheck line. And honestly, prior to, they broke through in a big way in the third period of game six. Kreider has the natural hat trick. Two of those goals come at 5-on-5. Before that, they had had just 2 5-on-5 goals combined in the first 5.5 or whatever games of that series. And that is an extension of the regular season where the Rangers 5-on-5 scoring was 3.5 goals per hour with Panarin and Lafreniere, and then down to 2.06 without them. So I don't know. That's interesting from Florida's perspective to kind of to go whether you want to go with the Forsling Ekblad pair and then potentially even Barkov, or whether we're going to see more Barkov versus Zibanejad and you split it up. I will say though, while obviously I love Forsling's game and he's done a phenomenal job, if you are Peter Laviolette and you're watching back the Panthers Bruins series from round two, I thought Ekblad's performance in that series was very alarming, particularly like he's always been a slower skater that's going to compensate for it with physicality. But the issue is this postseason, they're actually calling him on a lot of those infractions. And I think he got whistled for 4 penalties in round two. So he's not even getting away with that. And in particular, with Panarin playing on the left wing now, I imagine off the rush, which is something the Rangers have really embraced more this season, attacking, particularly with that line, he's going to get some opportunities to go mano a mano with Ekblad on the right side. And potentially, if he can attack him and force him to pivot and get himself into some awkward footwork situations, I actually do think that Panarin himself will be able to create stuff off the rush. So it'll be interesting to see if the Rangers can buck that trend of scoring line versus that pair being able to execute. But Panarin off the left wing, I actually think could target Ekblad a little bit, and that would be something that would be a point of emphasis for me if we are going to see those head-to-heads.
Yeah, and I think in this series, like I'm leaning a little bit more toward New York just because like I thought Florida was going to be able to sort of deal with the Bruins fairly easily, and the Bruins made the series way more interesting than I expected. And again, like not just because they were able to push it to six games, but also they were able to really take it to Florida for spurts. And I think the Rangers are a better team all around, and I would expect them to do a lot of the same things.
Yeah, I would as well. I will say though, you're right. Like that, particularly that game six was tight. At the same time, I had scoring chances for the series 130 to 78 for Florida. Like, despite the score lines, it was pretty slanted in their favor. And Jeremy Swayman, I think, did a lot to cover that up. Now, you could say the same about Igor Shesterkin in this one, but in projecting it, I think one reason why Florida wasn't able to separate themselves from Boston was, like, Verhaeghe and Tkachuk just weren't really producing particularly up to their standards. And that was a bit surprising to me because they were really good in round one. They had success against Boston previously. And in sort of projecting this series in the conference final, I do think there are going to be some opportunities for them to have success, especially if they're getting to play against other lines and not really top matchups against New York's defense pairs. But in particular, one way Kevin Woodley has noted how you can sort of relatively, I guess, beat Shesterkin. He's still so good that it's going to be easier said than done. But he's such a good skater as a goalie that he kind of aggressively comes out and challenges plays and then is able to recover. If you're able to work from behind the net and push him back to his post and kind of neutralize that a little bit, then a lot of those passes out front into the inner slot actually work pretty well. And we saw Carolina have a bit of success with that as the series progressed. And so that's why I think that it's going to be incumbent on Verhaeghe to certainly to score some goals, but I think like this could be a monster Matthew Tkachuk series, right? Because if there's anyone in the league that's set up to have success making plays from behind the net, it's him. That's his bread and butter. And so if they can get going and turn it on in this series, I do think they can have some success offensively against Igor Shesterkin.
Yeah, like I'd be really curious to see the kind of the one-on-one corner battles between Tkachuk and Trouba. That there's probably going to be a lot of toxicity there, and maybe some cross checks that may or may not get called, but we'll see.
Yeah, but I think that's a good thing for Florida, right? Because you just saw, I've noted kind of what they did to Charlie McAvoy in round two, and Trouba is going to be much more likely himself to drag himself out of plays, trying to sort of pursue that kind of physicality and throwing big hits. He's going to make a bunch of turnovers with the puck. And we always talk about Florida's forecheck against defenders. Beyond Adam Fox, who struggled in this postseason relative to his standards, there aren't very many puck moving options on this Rangers team. So I'm curious to see if they're just going to be content sort of flipping the puck out of the zone and playing it in the neutral zone and then trying to attack off of that, because I don't really see them having a lot of success actually trying to string together passes up the ice, especially against this Panthers very aggressive forecheck.
Yeah, but like that's what the Rangers do, right? Like they're not known as a team that's overly fancy or overly complex in their breakouts or on their regroups. So, that it's just gonna be more of the same for them.
One other note that I had on Tkachuk and Verhaeghe, I think part of this is why they struggled, was Bennett came back after his injury. And while there was all that noise about, his hit on Marchand and not being suspended for it, and then the goalie interference call in game four, you watch as that series progressed, and it's clear that his hand is still nowhere near 100%. He really couldn't handle the puck. And that was just killing a lot of sequences for them, to the point where in the clincher in game six, they put Lundell back on that line and they created a couple goals. So I'm looking for to see that, if that continues, or if Bennett's back there and he can be healthy and make some plays. Cause I just keep coming back to being like, all right, if Florida's going to be able to score goals against Shesterkin and the Rangers D, it's going to have to be coming through that line because of the way they attack. But I don't know. I'm curious for your take on this then, because in that Carolina New York series, we kept talking about how Shesterkin was having so much success because of Carolina's approach, right? Part of it is the shots from distance and sort of their defensemen just teeing off on these low percentage shots and feeding into his save percentage. But the other part of it was Carolina's a team that generates a lot of rebounds, and typically those come from in tight where it's difficult to elevate them and sort of purposefully get a good shot off. They're just quickly trying to jam it back into pads. We've seen Florida does sort of a similar thing. And I think part of why they sometimes struggle offensively or get bogged down and become inefficient is because of exactly that, where you watch them against Swayman and they're just getting a bunch of looks, but they're not scoring, and you become frustrated and you're wondering what's happening. Do you see that kind of being a bit of an issue in this series? Or do you think with some of the shooting talent they have, with guys like Reinhardt and Verhaeghe in particular, they're actually better suited to in tight turn some of those good looks into goals the way Carolina maybe wasn't able to?
I mean, like, it came out after the series that Seth Jarvis was basically like, he shouldn't have been playing sports at all. Like, his right shoulder was basically being held together with like physio tape or whatever. And so like a lot of it is like, you know, Jarvis being that player who can be good off the rush, but also around the net. Like, you know, that was a big piece of Carolina's offense and the kind of player that gives it a lot more variety. And perhaps, you know, with Florida, with Verhaeghe and with, you know, even Tarasenko, I think he's been a good pickup just in the sense that he gives them another top six forward who can kind of move up and down. I think Florida is a little bit better positioned to score goals, whether it's on counterattacks, whether it's off the entry or finding plays in tight. The thing with Shesterkin is that, you know, he is a smaller goalie. And one of the more underrated parts of Florida is like, they got some guys from the point who can actually score goals. Like Ekblad, as much as he struggles defensively, like, he's got a really good point shot. Ekman Larson is really underrated in terms of his ability to get the puck through traffic and hit his spots. Montour, obviously. So, you know, like, even though Carolina didn't really have a ton of success with sort of the low to high point shot approach, maybe Florida can, because they do have some players with the history of being able to actually score goals from the point, not just take tons of shots.
Yeah. And Carolina did have a bit of success with sort of deflections and kind of shot passes in that series against Shesterkin and all, really letting him get set. And I think Florida will be trying to kind of hunt that out and attack. And it's not like they're going to be all of a sudden shook, I think, coming into a series where the goalie's capable of playing really well and potentially stealing games, because they just went through that. I mean, Vasilevsky played a couple of amazing games in round one against them, but then Swayman, who has like a 900 save percentage against just slot shots alone this postseason, gave them certainly all they could handle. So that's interesting. Do you have any other notes on this series and this matchup? I think Hedl's health is interesting and kind of what that does to the bottom six, because Florida certainly got a lot of depth, and I don't think the Rangers will be able to kind of punt minutes. I think the Rangers will be happy with that Wennberg-Kako line, regardless of who's playing with them as the third wheel, in just trying to kind of control territory a little bit and just making sure no goals happen either way. I think they'll be happy with that at 5-on-5. But do you have any notes on either of these teams and kind of what you're looking for or ways they can attack their opposition?
Yeah, like you mentioned, whether it's Wennberg or Hedl or Kako, I think like it's a really nice opportunity for them, because I've always believed that as you get deeper in the postseason, it's like the quality of your third line starts becoming a factor, because, you know, teams are so good at pre-scouting and understanding how your best players attack that a lot of times, like, as you said, like, you can't afford to punt minutes with your third or fourth lines. And if you can, you know, win those shifts 1-0 or 2-1 over the course of a series, like, that really does make a difference. So again, like, you know, I think I talked about this before, but like, Kako hasn't really gotten a lot of love as Lafreniere's established himself as a top six player, but I would expect him to do some things, or, you know, I would hope that he could use this as an opportunity to really establish himself.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned Florida's defense and their aggressiveness in the O-zone. The last time you and I spoke, we did our second round preview, and we did it. That matchup between Carolina and New York started, game one happened before we recorded, and we sort of talked about that game as part of our preview of that series. And in that, I in passing, I think I noted how it was visible how guys like Braden Schneider and Ryan Lindgren were playing far more aggressively in the O-zone than I ever really recalled seeing them do. And in that game six clincher in Carolina, I'm not sure if people noticed, I've kind of pointed out on the Discord, but just I haven't talked about it on the podcast, Ryan Lindgren gets that breakaway, which is very surprising and out of character to see from him, because they were pushing up the ice. And Jordan Martinook obviously makes that heroic diving play where he jumps from pretty much inside the blue line and breaks it up at the goal line. But then on the series winning goal, it's Ryan Lindgren coming around the net, looping around, and then passing across ice for the Kreider tap in, and just seeing him sort of behind the other team's net creating a play like that. It's not something you're going to bank on with regularity, but I did think it was notable seeing that. And so if that can continue, I think that'll be an interesting way for the Rangers to manufacture a bit more offense against this Panthers team that doesn't really give up much defensively.
So you mentioned Lindgren, and these are the kind of things that teams are really tight-lipped about, but I wonder if injury is a factor there. Like in years past, I remember whenever I watched Lindgren, like especially in the playoffs, it seems like he was always carrying something, and you can see that he was hurt and he wasn't moving as well as he could. And like he could make plays. Like he's not a bad hockey player at all. And perhaps this year, maybe he's feeling healthier, or maybe Fox is carrying something, and all of a sudden he realizes that he's got to step up and be more aggressive and do more. And maybe that's what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, it's always interesting how we talk about defensemen creating offense and sort of the way we frame it, because I was watching here in Canada that the Sportsnet was broadcasting that series, and Louis DeBrusque was on the color commentary for it. And especially in games 5 and 6, he kept noting sort of the differences in approach between the two teams, where the Hurricanes were getting so many shot attempts and shots on goal and even points from their defensemen, and the Rangers weren't getting anything. And then he kind of noted that in conversations, Peter Laviolette actually wanted his defensemen to be a bit more involved and more engaged and more active in some of those stats. At the same time, though, I don't really view that as a negative thing. That's part of why the Rangers are so efficient, right? It's that they get the puck more down low. They rely more on their forwards setting the table and then executing. And so it's not a negative thing, but I think that's going to be another recurring thing probably in this series, because as you noted, I'm sure we're going to see a bunch of very high volume games from guys like Montour and Ekblad and even Ekman Larson. And you're just not really going to see that from this Rangers team, especially with Fox not really playing up to 100% of his capability.
Yeah. Do we have anything else on this series, or are we moving to the West now?
No, I think that's it. I think we move on to the West. I'm really excited about this one. You said you were leaning more towards the Rangers. I certainly think it could be a very, very competitive, potentially even 7-gamer. I'm slightly more in the Panthers' favor. I just think they have more ways that they could win this, but I think it'll be really close. All right, let's take our break here. And then when we come back, we'll move over to the West, and we're going to do our second conference final matchup deep dive, similar to what we just did here with Oilers Stars. So looking forward to that. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right, we're back here in the Hockey PDOcast, joined by Jack Hahn. We're doing our conference final preview. We did Panthers Rangers in the first block. We're going to switch gears here and talk about Stars Oilers. Jack, I'll give you the floor. What are you looking for in this matchup that really is going to catch your eye and you think is going to determine the way it goes?
So obviously Edmonton comes into the series, sort of very confident after dismissing the Canucks in 7 games, 7 hard-fought games. But the biggest weakness with the Edmonton Oilers, aside from goaltending, which is another kettle of fish, is that they're quite top heavy. Like, if you look at how Dallas comes into the series with Roope Hintz being sort of questionable with injury, being day-to-day, and then you look across at the Oilers, whether it's on forward or on defense, one injury can really derail their entire plans, because I would say in their top six, that they have 5 top 6 forwards, and they're essentially a team with one really good pair, one sort of okay depth pairing, and then one pairing that's pretty problematic. So for the Oilers, like, if they're healthy, they're in good shape. I think they're playing really well, especially on the power play, especially, in terms of managing the game at 5-on-5. But Dallas, again, comes to the series with a significant advantage in how deep they are.
Yeah, after a troublesome game 5 that we kind of broke down on this show before the weekend, they really bounced back. The Oilers did. Game 6 was very dominant. And then the first, whatever, 2 periods of game 7 before they went into a big time defensive shell and let the Canucks back into it, they really got back to playing their game. So I think that should inspire a lot of confidence. I do think, yeah, the fatigue thing is interesting, because we're getting into the third round here. We're getting into like deep waters where you're all of a sudden playing games 15, 16, 17, approaching game 20 of the postseason. And I think it applies to both ends though, right? Because for the Oilers, certainly they're not going to be able to withstand an injury to the top of their lineup, especially up front. For the Stars though, a big talking point for us has been they've used essentially 5 defensemen. In game 6 against the Avs, they finally brought in Alex Petrovich, of all people, into the lineup over Nils Lundqvist, and we're actually giving him regular shifts in that overtime. and trusting him more than they did Lundqvist at any point. Maybe, you know, we'll see what Yanni Hakanpää's status is and if he's able to come back at some point. And I'm sure they will give him a few more minutes, and this might be less of an issue just in terms of how much they're putting on the plate of their top four defenders. But for the time being, especially like Miro's playing over 28 minutes a game, I know that the Stars have had the benefit of nearly a full week off between the second round and third round, but I do think that kind of concept of fatigue and maybe potentially diminishing returns for their top players, despite Dallas's depth, and particularly it applies up front, no doubt. I do think in this case, it's a bit of a concern, I think, or kind of a thing to monitor for both those teams and not just necessarily Edmonton.
Well, the thing that really like makes me more at ease with Dallas's situation is obviously the top pair with Heiskanen and Harley, they're excellent. And their second pair is also still very dependable and very good, right? Whether it's Lindell and Tanev or Harley and Tanev, it doesn't really matter. Like Tanev was really a game changer for them. And I'm sure you talked about this with some of your other guests in the past, but the problem with Edmonton is that the second pair is their biggest problem, because Ekholm Bouchard, as far as I'm concerned, it's money in the bank. Whether you look at their offensive output, whether you know how they tilt the ice, it's that, again, that Nurse CC pair that, you know, they do use quite a bit, or at least even when they split them up, they use the individual players quite a bit, because, you know, they have that track record, they have that sort of name recognition. But again, like if your second pair is getting caved in, then it's a bigger problem than if your sixth defenseman is not in the game and you have to roll five.
Well, as that series went along, Chris Knobloch finally made the adjustment, like mercifully, of splitting up that pair, and predictably they had better results out of it. The good thing is that like Brett Kulak was made in a lab to be the best third pair defenseman of all time, essentially. I think you get into issues where you stretch him a little thin by putting too much on his plate and out of necessity asking him to play significantly more. I'm curious to see if that's something that crops up, because so far, you know, him and CeCe played about 50 minutes or so at 5-on-5 against the Canucks, and they were up 2-0 in those, including CeCe's game 7 goal, as he always does, seemingly. Kulak has been phenomenal, but you're asking that a lot of them, especially against some of the forwards that the Stars can throw at them. But you're totally right. Like in particular, Nurse, who was on the ice for 10 of Vancouver's 14 5-on-5 goals in the round 2 series, him and Vinny Desharnais are going to really struggle with speed coming at them, whether it's off the forecheck or attacking off the rush. And the Stars are so well suited to putting them in that bind, right? And I think that's where the difference really lies in this series for Edmonton compared to their first two series, where you're going from playing LA's offense, which is all volume and no quality, to Vancouver's offense, which is actually quite a bit of quality, but no volume and no real willingness or ability to generate off the rush. All of a sudden, the Stars are going to generate a ton of chances. They're going to attack you off the rush. They're going to put those players on the back foot, and they're going to do with a variety of different options, right? So a lot of the attention is going to come on Robertson and Wyatt Johnston, certainly deservedly so. But I actually think a guy like Matt Duchene and even Mason Marchment can really make an impact in this series, right? Because if they're getting all those minutes against Nurse and Desharnais, I would view them as pretty exploitable in that head-to-head and going downhill and creating a bunch of quality looks off the rush.
Yeah, and I think that was always Dallas's plan when they constructed their roster for this season. And again, you know, as you get deep in the playoffs and you start sort of having a really clear sense of what the other team's strengths and weaknesses are, the fact that you have three lines that essentially can score without also being, you know, defensive liabilities, that really helped.
I think we're going to get into the Oilers offense versus Stars defense in terms of the particulars of the players. But I did want to note in this series and thinking about it, Edmonton, for like you can see visibly the difference in their game in some of those head-to-heads against Vancouver, where they just, you know, they're struggling to get out of their zone cleanly against Vancouver's forecheck. And then that sort of stifled their ability to get set up in the offensive zone and put together long shifts there and cycle the puck the way you and I have spoken they like to do. And in this series, I think that's going to be a challenge for them, right? Because Dallas, you watch against Colorado, and there were spurts there where the Avs, just because they're so dominant, were able to string together with their top line and top pair minute long 90 second shifts where they were moving the puck around and getting them out of position and stacking chances together. But Dallas doesn't really surrender that much defensive zone time. And so for Edmonton, beyond, like, we'll talk about the power play and I'm sure they're going to create there, but just at 5-on-5 and even strength, what's your mileage or what's your take on like how they're going to be able to put together enough of an attack there? Because they're not like McDavid's going to attack off the rush. They've got, like, I really like what I've seen from Holloway recently, but for them to be at their best, they need to just keep at Dallas in their own zone and tire them out and take away their legs by cycling the puck. And Dallas just won't really let you do that. At least they haven't to Vegas and Colorado in the first two rounds.
Yeah, and the thing with the Oilers is they've gone back to that McDavid, Hyman, Nugent Hopkins top line, which has been really good in the regular season. And the problem that creates is for Draisaitl, basically their top six has five legit players on it. And the second line obviously is centered by Draisaitl, but then recently he's been playing with Evander Kane and Holloway, right? So Holloway is a rookie. He doesn't really have a ton of experience in these situations. Good puck carrier, maybe overhandles the puck a little bit, which makes him a less effective shooter. You know, when Draisaitl's carrying the mail, Evander Kane is what he is at this point. I think he's been really engaged physically, but if you look at in bigger samples, the play driving has really fallen off. He can still score goals when the puck is near the opposing net, and he can cause some problems on the forecheck, but just not as consistent on the puck as, you know, you would like your top six center to be at the, sorry, your top six forward to be at this time of year. So, you know, if Dallas is able to sort of shut down the second line, that puts a lot of pressure on McDavid's unit to create, which, you know, obviously it's not ideal for a friend.
Yeah, it's not ideal. When you were talking, I was curious, and you mentioned a couple times they have five top six forwards and that's one short. I assumed you were including Kane as one of those five. I agree with you. They have five out of six, but I would include Holloway there instead. I do think, regardless of the overhandling and all that, and I'm like, he's a young, inexperienced player. He's going to have to refine certain things in his game. But I just think it's like visible. You watch him, the juice he has off the rush, skating ability, his ability to kind of create. I think that really helps Leon in this case, because he can take a bit of the burden off him as a puck carrier in transition, but it can also just make life a little bit easier with just having that skating ability and being able to get into certain spaces. And so they're going to have to rely on him in this series, because at the start of round two against Vancouver, they loaded up that top line because I think they were a bit iffy on Dreisaitl's health. In this series, they don't really have the luxury, in my opinion, of going that route, right? Because Dallas just, like, they have three scoring lines, and even we saw they're comfortable using Steele and Smith against your other team's top line and still winning some of those minutes and creating themselves. They could get away with it, the Oilers could, against Vancouver, just because they had so few scoring options, and there were a bunch of minutes where the two teams almost had a gentlemanly agreement that the bottom sixes just would kind of even out and not really test each other. In this series, if they load up the top line, I'm sure they're going to have success, particularly with that five-man unit, with that top pair with them. But then in everything else, it's going to be a nightmare scenario, because you're going to be exposing guys to all of a sudden minutes against, whether it's Johnston and Stankoven or Duchesne and Marchman and Pavelski or Sagan, whoever's with them. And it just becomes like an untenable situation for me. So do you agree that in this series, you just can't really get away with, at least full time for extended stretches, playing that top line together? I think you need Draisaitl to be able to carry his own line and come out even or ahead at 5-on-5, regardless of who he's playing with.
Yeah, I certainly not ideal to be a one-line team this time of year. And you, like, we saw how Dallas was able to really sort of pull away from Colorado once they became a one-line team with Nichushkin being out with you know, his off-ice issues. So I think Dallas is going to be prepared for that. You know, obviously McDavid and Draisaitl is one of the best duos in the league right now, but just like MacKinnon and Rantanen, and Dallas was able to contain.
They were. And part of the reason they were able to contain is Chris Tanev, similar to what we said about Forsling in the first block, is having just an unbelievable start to this postseason, where round one plays 46 and a half minutes against Eichel. The Stars win those minutes 3-0. Round two plays 69 extremely nice minutes against Nathan MacKinnon, and the Stars win those minutes 3-1. And here's what I'm curious. I want to ask you about this then. in stacking together the game plan for this series with the benefit of time between games and with the fact that Peter DeBoer has last change, what do you think his approach is going to be for how he's going to defend these guys considering they're not playing together? Do you think if Rupe Hintz is healthy, he'll go with sort of him and that Miro Hanley or Harley pair against McDavid and then use Tanev against Dreisaitl? Or do you think the fact that Tanev has had so much success against rush guys like Eichel and Nathan MacKinnon so far that he's just going to keep riding that hot hand and play him more against McDavid? What do you think is sort of the optimal deployment situation for the Stars against Edmonton's top two guys?
I mean, as good as Tanev has been, like, I would feel more comfortable with Heiskanen against McDavid. And then the other sort of more team level thing is that Dallas plays sort of similar to Vancouver in terms of their neutral zone forecheck and their D zone coverage. Like, it's fairly passive, except Dallas, like, they have better players up and down the lineup. So their players get there a little bit earlier. And I think they counterattack a little bit better. But so for Dallas, if they start seeing, the Oilers' top players being a problem off the rush, they can basically just either clog the neutral zone and play a trap and hope to create some turnovers, or just let them come into the D zone, get into their zone coverage, protect the middle of the ice, and then force, you know, the McDavids or the Dreisaitls or Nugent Hopkins to sort of overplay the puck and then hurt them on the counterattack. So that was Vancouver's plan as well. And if, you know, the one thing that I think as a Canucks fan, obviously we're disappointed that, you know, the Canucks lost, but they were the ones who dictated the tempo of the game. Like, basically nothing really happened. The games were very low event. And if Dallas keeps the game low event like Vancouver was able to do, they're probably going to win because they got better finishing. They got better defensemen. They have better, you know, better power play. So again, if, you know, the shots end up being like 20 to 15 over the course of a full game, then I think it's going to be advantage Dallas.
Well, they were certainly comfortable doing that and actually went out of their way to do so at times against Colorado. And it's understandable. I think it was sort of a sign of respect to what Colorado's capable and what they did to Winnipeg in round one. I think, you know, what's fun about the playoffs is from round to round, you essentially get these stylistic differences in the matchups, and then teams sort of, the good teams who are able to and have the personnel to do so, change up their approach depending on who they're playing, and certain guys are relied upon a bit more than others. I actually think I might go the other way in this series, where Edmonton's certainly dangerous and you don't necessarily want to get into a situation where you're trading chances with Dreisaitl and McDavid. But just based on some of the defensive personnel issues we talked about and the fact that, you know, Stuart Skinner played well in the two games to close out the Vancouver series, but his one struggle is stopping shots off the rush and when you get moving side to side, and LA and Vancouver just for a variety of reasons weren't able to really do that and test him when he was in there for the most part. I think Dallas is certainly qualified and capable of doing so. And so if I were them, I would almost be preaching pushing more aggressively and ramping up the tempo in this series and testing Edmonton that way. And then if that doesn't work out and you wind up being burned early on, then maybe dialing it back and trapping it up a bit more. But I would almost be the aggressor here. It seems like you kind of disagree and you'd go the other route.
Oh no, like if I'm Dallas, I would start by not parking the bus, but forcing Edmonton to do something special. And if they can't quite pull it off, then hurt them with, you know, a half ice counterattack.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, certainly asking them to do something special, I think they're more than capable. And McDavid, for his superhuman standards, was relatively held in check by the Miller line in that series. And it kind of broke through in game six in particular. But Dreisaitl, man, we have to give him a little bit of love here because he's got 24 points in 12 games. I tweeted this out after game seven. He's been on the ice for 32 Oilers games in just 253 minutes so far this postseason. That's 7.6 goals per hour all situations, which is just freakish. And if we do see him against Tanev, not only is it going to be two guys playing at the top of their position head-to-head right now, but I actually think Dreisaitl could do okay in that because he doesn't have the speed of McDavid, certainly, but he can challenge Tanev with his puck protection, with his size, with his physicality, and potentially put him in a bit of a bind there. So I'm really curious to see how that plays out. Do we have anything like we can't do this preview without talking about the Oilers power play? When we did the breakdown of the round two matchup against Vancouver, we spent quite a bit of time discussing sort of the bind they put you in and what you could potentially do to give yourself at least a bit of a fighting chance. And the conclusion we came to was nothing really much other than hoping and praying they don't succeed. Dallas has done a really good job this postseason of being disciplined and not taking penalties. They've only been shorthanded 26 times in their 13 games. No team has spent less time PKing than them. So maybe that is the answer. And they just keep this at 5-on-5 and get away with it. But in these situations where Edmonton gets on the power play, do we have anything to offer in terms of what you can do other than hope and pray? Like it pretty much, I think, comes down to just living with the fact that Bouchard will probably get some close range point shots and hope he misses the net and the puck clears the zone, because otherwise, good luck.
So actually, I thought the Canucks, as the series went on, they started doing a better job by doing the opposite of what I expected, which is they were more aggressive on Bouchard, especially on their power play breakout, and they're actually trying to score against that unit. Like, for as much as Elias Patterson struggled during the series at 5-on-5, I thought he was actually quite good on the PK. Like, some of his best rush opportunities that he created were off the PK, where whether it was him or his line mate forced a turnover up ice, and they were actually able to get some rush shots, and maybe that's the way to do it. So instead of because last time I was here, I talked about how maybe you let Bouchard take the shot from the point, but no, maybe it's you give Bouchard no time with the puck, you force him to rush a play, you create turnovers in a neutral zone, and then you try to score against this unit shorthand.
Well, that's what Dallas was doing to the Avs, right? And that's why they had some success penalty killing against a very good power play themselves. And in particular, I think you're right on the Pettersson point. The issue is that much like a lot of his minutes, whenever he would be in that situation, the pass would go to like Phil DiGiuseppe or some other fourth liner that just wouldn't really capitalize on it. In this case, Dallas can hopefully do the same, or will try to. But the players will be Wyatt Johnson and Sam Steele or Roope Hintz and Tyler Seguin or some combination of more skilled, better finishers. And so all of a sudden, maybe they can actually create some really dangerous looks and potentially goals off that. So now that's an interesting thing to watch for. You got any other stuff on this series in terms of notes or things to watch for?
I mean, I continue to be concerned about the Oilers goaltending situation, but what there's not a whole lot we can do at this point.
No, there's not. Especially if they're going to be conceding rush shots, which is just like Vancouver just had no interest in really testing them there. And I think that's kind of inexcusable. I get that that's part of their DNA, and ultimately you can't really change it on the fly like that because you just have this personnel group and you've had success playing a very disciplined certain way defensively. But I think Dallas would be well, would do well to change that and really test them. On the other hand, though, like Dallas has given up 18 5-on-5 goals in 13 games to Vegas and Colorado so far. And in that closeout game six on the road, it went into second overtime and they held Colorado to 30 shots on goal and eight high danger chances in like whatever, 5 periods or so, 4.5 periods. So they're playing so well defensively that it's going to be a bit of an uphill climb, I think, for Edmonton to create much of 5-on-5. And it's just going to take superhuman efforts from Draisaitl and McDavid. But that's been the case for a while now. So that's not necessarily groundbreaking news. All right, Jack. We did it. We previewed the conference finals. I will let you plug some stuff on the way here. Let the listeners know where they can check you out and what you're going to have on the go here in the latter stages of the postseason.
Yeah, so obviously I've been here quite a few times already, so this time we'll do something different. If you have a hockey tactics related question, feel free to DM me on Twitter. My DMs are open. Or if you don't use Twitter, you can actually email me at jack.han at hey.com. So J-H, sorry, sorry, J-A-C-K dot H-A-N at HEY.com.
I love it. I love your Twitter AMAs. You do a good job on those. And you know what? You know what else people can do to reach you? They can also just tag you on the PDOcast Discord server, whether it's in the mailbag section or just in any of the channels, because you jump in there from time to time and answer questions and pop in and stuff. So maybe we'll start doing that a bit more often, because I know the listeners really enjoy interacting with you and asking you these questions, but also the Discord itself just is a great time. So that's my plug, as always. The invite link is in the show notes. If you're not in there, get in there and mix it up with us during these conference finals. So That's all for today. We've got a big week of shows planned. We'll see you right back here tomorrow for a special treat I've been cooking up. But in the meantime, hopefully you enjoyed our conference final preview. And thank you for listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.